Hello.
It's Jody Barton.
It is. Hey, Tyler Beck. How are you doing, sir?
Good, buddy. This is episode 255 of Highway Diary with my guest, Dr. Jody Byron, Dr. Jody Barton, Esquire. He was recovering in Florida with an illness. Not coronavirus. What were you sick in Florida with? And who did you stay with, Jody?
It was not me who was sick. It was a friend of mine who was sick in Florida. So that's who I was staying with and visiting with.
What a humanitarian.
Well, I don't know if I'd go that far, but
Can we talk about our friendship?
Absolutely.
All
sure.
Right.
Of course.
So I met you. Let's just talk about Dr. Jody Barton, who I met. He was fleeing to Los Angeles. We all lived in a house in Van Nuys together. My random roommate. And he's like, I was a trial lawyer in Texas. I was fighting for human rights. They didn't pay us enough to be a do-gooder. Can you talk about that at all?
Sure. I don't know if it's that they didn't pay us enough to be a do-gooder is why.
What? Was that the most disrespectful thing possible to say?
No, it wasn't disrespectful. I'm only clarifying that it wasn't the money that they could not continue with that work. But yeah, no. In Texas, I practiced law with a criminal defense attorney for a little over a year. And then worked at with the Texas Civil Rights Project, a nonprofit civil rights organization out of Austin, Texas, and did that for 4 years before packing up all my stuff in my little car and moving out to Los Angeles.
Okay. Did you work on any police brutality cases?
I worked on some prison brutality cases. But not cops, not personally cops in the street. Our organization did work with police brutality cases, yes. But much of the work I did was with prisoners' rights as well as disability rights.
Now, was the main thrust of your argument that my client should not have been in the same cell as this client? He was raped or beat up. What was your thing?
Well, that would be an argument in that situation if that was happening. Unfortunately, the cases that I often dealt with were suicides, and so it was more about the treatment and the conditions that the prisoner was living in, and the care and the way that they were being looked after by the staff, and what the responsibilities of the staff, given that they were fully in charge of this person, are to the person. So that was more specifically the kind of things that I did. We did do some First Amendment work on protesters and fighting to allow protesters to be in public. We had a case where when George Bush was president, where George Bush was leaving. He was at some building, I don't remember what it was, but he was leaving it, and there were people who were protesting him, and the federal government moved the protesters from the area in front where they could see the car as it was coming out, and forced them to go to a place where they never even could see George Bush. So they never officially got to protest what they wanted to, and we fought that in court and won. And got a ruling that the federal government was not within their legal requirements and what they did. So,
right.
so that's the kind of thing we did. So that, I guess, in some ways relates to what's going on today.
You know, you're showing up to court over and over and over again. You're saying, look, my textbook in law school says this. You know, I don't give a shit what you're talking about. This is what my textbook says. This is a law. You know, you're fighting, and then you see a play in a community theater production in Texas, somewhere around Houston, maybe Katy, Texas. Where was that theater? What production did you see?
It's great. You remember my life in a way where you have the gist of it. You seem to have a grasp of what my path has been in life, but you're just off on the facts.
Okay, enlighten me. If we're in the court of public opinion right now, you know, how am I wrong?
I think it's great, man. I think it's endearing. It means you have remembered the stories that we've talked about and the history that has gotten me to where I am today. There are just some little facts that are you just remember differently, which is funny.
All right. I smoke a lot of marijuana. And
yeah,
go. How am I wrong? And go.
How are you wrong? Like generally, like in a number of different things.
Okay.
My.
Well, we can talk about. We were roommates, and you had a rabbit one time as a pet.
Yeah,
so we can talk about things that people did differently, and the rabbit ate the wires of the cable.
Yeah.
So if you want to talk about, you know, my life. You know, we could talk about that in a combative way, but I was trying to ask in a friendly way.
By the way, and then I went out of town, and the three of you killed the rabbit. And then I came back, and you told me that you found a nice home for it.
He's in the pasture.
You
don't know about the golden pasture of California?
Rabbit murder.
No, he's out to pasture, you know.
Out to, is that what you call it? Out to pasture?
And was delicious and jerk sauce. But we'll talk about that later. So, you're a lawyer, right?
Uh-huh.
You're reading textbooks all day. Your Honor, I think these people have the First Amendment right to protest. That's what I think. I don't know. I've only, you know, graduated recently, but that's what they said in the fucking textbooks. You see a play, a community theater play. What is this play? Something happened to you that night. And I know this because we're good friends. What happened?
All right. So I did not see a play. When I was younger, when I was in school, in middle school, in high school, I did drama clubs and plays in high school and was very involved in those things and always loved doing it. And I had said... to myself that at some point in my life when I had a regular schedule, a 9-to-5 kind of schedule, that I'd love to go do some theater somewhere. Much of my life I've been bartending, I was DJing for a long time, I was doing a lot of things that were odd hours and didn't give me a consistent schedule. So once I started working at the law office in Austin, after a couple of years, I remembered that I told myself I wanted to do that. And so I signed up and went and took an acting class at the Paramount Theater in Austin, Texas. And after the first class, I remember the improv we did and the first line I said and just how it all went. I remember leaving the class and saying, I should have been doing this all along. And then I, of course, continued to go to the classes and then that built into getting headshots and auditioning for some student films at UT and those things. And so that's what sparked the fire in me and made me say, this is something I want to pursue before I die. So.
What was the teacher's name?
Babs George was the teacher's name.
And what did Babs... Did she give something to you spiritually?
It was more of the act of doing it that is what is where that connection came from. I mean, certainly the teacher Babs and then Amber Dupuis as well, who's another teacher there. Both of them fed into that, but it was getting in front of people and spitting out. The energy of this character that it was feeling and being able to do that unfiltered was really freeing. And we brought up spiritual. There's a spiritual connection with it where, you know, when you don't filter yourself because you don't have to worry about your inhibitions when you're playing a character, when you're playing something else, you can just let that go and let the character come out as it does. And so when I started doing that, gave me something that I forgot that I needed. Mm.
And you moved to L.A. What was that like? How'd you do it?
Well,
you packed a car? What'd you do?
I did. That part, that's correct. I packed a car. I packed my little Honda Civic. Kind of gave away or sold anything that wouldn't fit in the car and drove to L.A. With what I thought was a lot of money in the bank. It wasn't a lot of money in the bank. And got here, and, you know, within a year I was broke and struggling to survive, and, you know.
And what year was that?
So I moved here. I lived in Toluca Lake for the first year and a half, and pretty quickly my savings went out, but I did get a job bartending, but it was mostly just keeping me afloat. And so that, I did that for about a year and a half before I then moved to Culver City and worked as a bar manager, and then moved over to the Palisades, which is the place I lived at before I moved in with you and Heather and Sergio.
And Heather one time,
lost my job.
She found a rabbit. I can tell you exactly why you lost your job. Heather found a rabbit one time. We had a roommate meeting, you know, about this and that, you know, cleaning or this or that, you know. You brought up, hey, side note, I'm a humanitarian. I'm a spiritual person. You know, I'm an actor. I'm in my body. I like other beautiful beings, you know. I will take care of this rabbit. Do you remember? Okay. Am I lying? I'm lying right now.
No. You're not lying about the substance of what you're saying.
Okay.
The words you use is probably not how I presented it. But yes, I did claim that I would commit myself to being responsible for the care of this rabbit.
Right.
Yeah.
And what qualifications did you have going into that job? Have you been a dog owner? Have you been a cat owner? Did you eat a? You kept the fish together.
No, I've been a cat owner for sure. I am a bit of a cat whisperer.
Okay.
I do have a knack with cats, and dogs I'm pretty good with too. And I felt like me and the Pope had a connection, and that he was the right fit for the house. And that
now,
I
yeah, okay. Yeah. Can I stop you there? Now, I grew up Catholic. Okay, you introduced him to the house as the Pope. I did feel a level of reverence for this creature, right?
Yeah.
But then things took a turn. How was it to raise the Pope?
The Pope was more difficult than I had anticipated. We didn't have a space. We didn't have a good space for him. He was left to wander around sometimes under his own devices, I guess, which meant he was just leaving little shit pebbles everywhere. And then he chewed on a wire or two. It wasn't like he chewed up all our wires.
Now, you had like a certain cabinet. I remember we kind of divided the cabinet food storage space in a certain way. Now, was the Pope briefed on whose food was yours as the owner of Pope versus other people's food, or where to poo, you know?
I don't remember if he had a did he eat somebody else's food? I'd have had to talk to him about that if I could.
Yeah, because so, was he at the roommate meeting, or is that like a vague part of the details that you're like forgetting?
Was the Pope at the meeting? I don't think he needed to be there, but if there was an issue with him eating somebody else's food, then that, you know, should have been brought to me.
The problem is I grew up Catholic. I called him Your Eminence. So when I addressed the Pope, I said, Your Eminence is required at the, you know, and when he would run around and shit, I just felt like, look, he's doing his thing. You know, yeah. Who am I, a peasant of this creature, to say anything?
Well, I think that your reverence for him could partially be responsible for the his ego, I guess, and the way that he would walk around the house and confidently shit on the floor.
See, as his caretaker, that's disrespectful of you to say of the situation. You're his caretaker, right?
I said it, and I was the one responsible for cleaning up the ego shit. Yeah.
So, you're at a weird time in your life. It's 2012. You move into Van Nuys, California, into a house with a bunch of roommates. They all have their own dreams. They have their own aspirations. You do a movie called Hate Crime, which is really fucked up, with James Cullen Brusick.
Yeah.
So you go from being a lawyer, fighting for justice, to an awakened actor, and now you find yourself in a movie. How'd that come about? How'd you meet James?
I met James. I was working in Culver City, managing a bar out there, and I was submitting and acting in everything that I could. And I had submitted my demo reel to James for a film that he did called My Pure Joy that he did not call me in for. But he saw it and liked it, and he had written a short film that he was doing called Unmindly Demise. And he called me up and said he saw my reel and wanted to cast me in the role. And so I looked James up. He was a 19-year-old kid. He sent me the script. It was some seemingly dumb script about a mime and mimes as weapons. And it didn't make any sense to me. And I thought, I don't think I want to do this. And then I remembered that I had kind of told myself anytime, especially at this point in my career, if somebody calls me up and asks me to come and do something, they're not asking me to audition for it, it's something that looks like it could be fun to do, that I don't want to turn those opportunities down. I want to say yes to it. So I did. And I got on set and very quickly realized that James was somebody who had a vision and had a desire, I guess, for filmmaking that I hadn't seen yet in my few years in L.A. So, and we worked really well together. So we did that, and we did that project, and I don't know, a month later he called me up and said he had this really crazy fucked up film and really wanted me to play one of the main bad guys in it. And I read it and I agreed with him. It was a really fucked up film, but the part seemed crazy enough to be the kind of thing I'd love to do, and so I jumped on.
Right. And you did this ever get put into an anthology with other short movies and hosted by a hilarious person? This project. What happened to the project?
Let me see.
Can I follow up with the project, though, of Untimely Demise?
You don't want to move on to my other project?
Huh?
Can I talk about where Unmindly landed?
Do you hear this? I've prepared for this interview. Right now, we're at 2013.
Okay.
I'm looking at your IMDb. Theater of the Deranged 2.
So I believe what happened in 2013 was the short film Untimely Demise was included in the anthology Theater of Deranged 2, which is currently out now on a number of different platforms. And in that anthology, is hosted by none other than Damien Shadows, played by Mr. Eric Hollerback, who narrates the stories in between each film and brings them together with his spells and humor and beautiful hair.
So I had some hair at this time, but I wore a wig because it was going quick.
Yeah, mine's doing the same.
You were telling me about magnesium. Are you rubbing magnesium in your head every day? And then we'll get back to Theater of the Range too. My hair still, was still, falling.
Still rubbing the magnesium oil in my area.
Is that protecting you from COVID?
No. No, it doesn't have anything to do with COVID, I don't think.
All right. So let's go back to 2011. I saw you do a play in a mansion that was owned by a member of the Illuminati. You did a play.
I said no, that's not the case.
But remember, I said in 2011.
You need to move my car.
All right.
Go ahead. Keep going. I'm going to keep moving. I'm going to have to move my car. Keep going. I just get.
Oh, the rental space wore out.
Yeah. I'm parked behind a roommate. But we're good. Keep going.
All right, you got to move your car. Do you want to take 5 minutes, or you got this?
I think I'm good.
Okay, so I show up to a mansion, and you're in some sort of cult that's...
Nope.
What?
Sorry, keep going, sorry.
But I'm lying to you when I say that I showed up to see you in a play in a mansion. That's a lie.
No, that is correct.
In 2011.
I don't know if that's the year, but yeah, you did come and see me do a play at I can't remember his name, famous director.
Oh, a member of the
Iron Man 3.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, I was wrong about a member of the Illuminati then.
might be, I don't know.
Yeah, I was probably wrong about that then. So I show up to a play. Now, was this the same play you were in a community theater in Houston when you got the acting bug?
Same play that I was in, you said?
Yeah. You were in a community theater play that gave you the acting bug?
We cleared this up.
Okay.
It wasn't a community theater thing. It was a acting class.
The kids love that. So, and then you moved into Van Nuys, you know, and we're living in a house together. We're roommates. Sometimes I made you move your car because you were blocking my Honda Civic EX from 2002. So I said, hey, move your car. So I said, hey, run outside right now, because that was an ideal living condition. I go to see her play at the house owned by the Illuminati member. But you're bit by some sort of acting bug so hard, you know, you start to rattle off. This is where I want to say you're really active on IMDb. You go on to do a film in 2013 called To Jennifer. To Jennifer. T-O. This is a love ode to Jennifer, directed by James Cullen Brosek. What was that like? How was that?
That was great. That was after Hate Crime. James was doing a film in Virginia with Chuck Pappas they ended up having to stop shooting. And so while they were up there, they thought, well, let's still make something. Let's still try to create something. And James picked up the phone and just started filming Chuck. And they started kind of making this movie, and they filmed all the way back. They filmed on the flight, and they filmed all the way back to L.A. And then when they got in town, James called me and said, you know, we have this idea for this thing. We've been shooting it. We're about a third of the way through, and we'd love to bring you on to be a part of it. And again, I jumped on it. By that afternoon, they were at our house. Some of that is shot at our house, our old house. I was shooting my first scene by that afternoon. So, you know, the idea behind the project of To Jennifer was technology is at a place where we can, you know, anybody, you can pick up your phone, you can pick up any number of different types of cameras these days and start shooting something, start being creative, and you don't need a big budget to do it. So that's really what To Jennifer was about. And so we were really happy with it and proud of it.
You know, and there were a couple movies that came out that year, like Catfish, where it's like it shot for $2,500. So you're now using technology to make something off grid, you know, that's not part of the Hollywood system. Then there's a movie called Two Jennifer, which is the numerical two and then Jennifer. And how soon was that shot after the first one? Two Jennifer, T-O.
Yeah, so it was probably about a year and a half, maybe 2 years after Two Jennifer came out, that James was working with Hunter Johnson on the set of a film, and Hunter approached James about a sequel. He had seen the original movie and really liked it and had an idea for how to take the story into a different direction. And James said, well, if you want to write a script, and he said within a few days, Hunter came back with a script, and James read it and loved it, and so they moved forward with it. It was a story about a guy who gets obsessed with the original film and then ended up stalking and then killing some of the people from the original film. So it was a meta film, you know, in the style of Human Centipede 2, something like that, where somebody watched the movie and then got obsessed and came back, and so it became a movie about a movie, but also shot completely on an iPhone from character perspective. So it kept the similar style and theme that the first one had.
Right. So around this time, we separate as roommates, not as friends. I go to New Orleans. I go get into a program for... I was working on reality shows. I get in a program to screenwrite at the University of New Orleans. I get a phone call from Dr. Jody Barton Esquire, who tells me, I just got a job. I go, oh yeah, you got a job. You're on a movie? You know, what do you need? You know, a pep talk? You know, what do you need? And you're like, oh, I'm the general manager of the Comedy Store. Right? So I think that happened right after Two Jennifer. Right?
No. That happened a little bit, a good bit after Two Jennifer. I had done a few other projects before then. That was in 2016 is when I was hired on at the Comedy Store.
And, all right. Well, that's the same year Two Jennifer came out, 2016. How did that process go? So you're in L.A., you know? Yeah. This acting thing, you move out of your house in Van Nuys, you're down in Culver City somewhere in an apartment, then you leave that place because your other roommates are doing drugs, right? So, well... What happened after you moved out of Van Nuys? What kind of roommates did you have?
Oh yeah, after I moved out of where were you guys?
Yeah.
Where did I move after I moved? After
Culver City, right? Back to Culver City?
No, I don't think so.
No? Sherman Oaks? Where'd you go?
Did I move in hold on. No, you're right, I did. I did move to Culver City because I was working at Primitivo. Yep. Yeah, okay. Now, yeah, I moved to that great place down off Rose Avenue, right by the beach in Venice, where my roommate got in a fight with my other roommate, and then the landlord found out we were living there, and they weren't supposed to be subletting to us, and then within 2 months, we all got kicked out of this fantastic place. And so then I moved to another place in Culver City that wasn't as great with a roommate.
All right. And how was the parking situation at the second Culver City place when you had to move your car? Did the other roommate have to move, you know, that kind of thing?
No, I think if I remember right, it was his place that he owned, and he rented out the room, and so I had street parking always. So I wasn't even allowed in the thing. But I will tell you that the practice that I got for moving my car when I was living with you is what made me able to do it in this situation as quickly and as efficiently as I did.
What do you mean?
Well, meaning the fact that I had to move my car a lot from you when we were living together.
Right.
So just now, 10 minutes ago, when I was asked to move my car, I was able to do it really quickly and get back in here and just do it very efficiently. And that was because I had to do it a number of times with you, and so I practiced and I've gotten good at it.
All right. So some other really cool stuff happened in my life because of Jody Barton being in my life. I was at a master's program, and some guy, so I started a roast battle in New Orleans, and I actually talked to Jay Layton on the phone, and he gave me advice how to have a roast battle. I started having one. Then something happened where someone I was beefing with in New Orleans put out that I was stealing the roast battle, okay? So that was very embarrassing to me. I called the people directly who run it, right? I called Jody. I go, yo, I need to do a roast battle, man. You're running shit in the... So then I go to Los Angeles to the Comedy Store, and I lose a roast battle to Eric Wargo. I say, I want to go back. I lose another roast battle to Keith Carey. Devastating. Later on, you know, I start fucking with the Comedy Store. You're in there. I need a personal meeting. Don't worry about why. I need a personal meeting with Tom Rhodes, my hero. Jody, behind the scenes, he's working there. He puts it together, you know? I had a man on the inside.
I love Tom Rhodes.
Were some of the people, as you were the general manager of the Comedy Store, were some of the comics rude to you? And how was Tom Rhodes?
Almost none of the comics were rude to me.
Okay.
Tom Rhodes is great. One of the nicest guys around. In my position at the store, I didn't have, as the general manager, I was in charge of the day-to-day operations, but I didn't put people on stage. We had Adam Egan, our talent coordinator, and Emily LaFord, who put the shows on and put the talent on and book the comics and do that. So they have a specific relationship with the comics because all the comics are trying to get stage time. With me, it was different, but all of the comics, for the most part, particularly the established comics, all appreciate and respect the Comedy Store itself, the history of the store, everything that the store has been and stood for stand-up comedy for 40 years. And so they always treated me with respect, and I have some great relationships with staff and comics, and of course a lot of the staff are comics and all that too. Outside of a couple incidents, there was no real issues with comics.
Did Joey Diaz fight somebody in front of you? Joey Coco Diaz. You know, he's a nice guy, but he's from Jersey, like me. I'm from Jersey. You know, the problem with people from Jersey is they don't take a lot of guff. They don't like Hollywood bullshit. And they're like kind of, they confront people. Sure. Did you see any of this?
Sure. Joey is one of the absolute nicest guys in the world. And so when Joey comes through the Comedy Store, the staff gets really happy. Because he's just as nice and friendly as can be, and everybody at the store loves Joey. But there are certainly times when, you know, if you get on Joey's wrong side, that he gets a little upset, and when he gets upset, he's a big guy and gets aggressive. So I've certainly seen Joey get aggressive, as I've seen, you know, other comics. But when Joey does it, it's a little stronger than most people. But really, honestly, he's one of the nicest guys.
All right. So I go to... Maybe I shouldn't say things that you tell me offline, online. After I graduate, I got my faggy liberal arts degree. I go to Los Angeles. I see Jody, you know, in this role as the general manager of the place that to me is the greatest comedy club in the world, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, you asked me to color correct a movie called For Jennifer, F-O-R.
Yeah.
You go, do you know anybody about this, right?
Yeah.
So what happened there?
Well, I found somebody to color correct.
Huh?
I found somebody to color correct For Jennifer.
On your own, or did you make some phone calls?
I think I found it through somebody else that was one of my producers on the project.
Lies.
So yeah, that was
lies.
I don't think. Did I find him through you?
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right, I did. Oh, you're right, I did. Colin.
Yeah. So right, Colin of Tulsi Productions.
Yes.
You know.
My fault.
He color corrected right, For Jennifer. Now, For Jennifer is a different Jennifer movie. This one, James took a back seat, right? He goes, this is a franchise I have. You know, maybe you want to do this. Maybe you want to produce this. Maybe I taught you some spiritual skills that a movie doesn't have to cost $70 million. Maybe it could cost $7,100, right? So yeah. You're the director now.
Yep. Yeah.
For Jennifer, F-O-R. What was it like to take the reins of the franchise?
It was great. James came to me by 3 years ago now, and asked me if I had any interest in doing it. Frank Merle had made a film called From Jennifer, which is actually the third film in the series, which doesn't necessarily relate in content to the first two films, but is shot in the same way, where it's shot from the perspective of the characters. Frank brought in GoPro cameras along with the iPhone to kind of use the technology of the day to enhance the way he was shooting it, but it also kept a very low budget. So when James came to me about For Jennifer and I started thinking about the idea of doing it and what the story could be, I had gone back and watched, you know, the other movies all together, and I saw just a thread of storyline through all of them that I thought could bring them together. So so in writing it, that was the direction I was going, and the idea was to make a film that was a standalone film that you could watch on your own without needing to have seen any of the other films, but that after watching it, it might pique your interest and get you to want to watch the rest of the series.
Now, you hosted a party, right? So the whole first part of For Jennifer is a party scene. How much were you like, look, I paid this and this and this? I'm filming this for film, and how much of that turned into just a crazy party?
Well, look, fortunately for me, the people that I worked with, James and Hunter and Frank, as my producers, as well as Nick Keckers and Jared First, they all are in the independent film community, and they all have worked in independent and particularly in horror film. And so they were able to reach out to friends of theirs, people who are big in the independent horror film community. Not only people who make independent horror films, but people who are fans and people who like to dress in costume and enjoy that experience. And so we were able to reach out to some people, and they were very much on board with coming out and having a horror film party. And so we, you know, we provided some booze and put on the music and hung out. And I think everybody had a really good time. That, you know, that all of those scenes from the party scene, which is kind of the introductory scene to the film, all of that is improvisational. It's all allowing them to be the characters and the talented people that they are within the scene. So that was great. That was a lot of fun to shoot, and it was great to have a lot of people that were excited to be a part of it and involved in it.
So you call me. I'm in my senior year at the University of New Orleans. Maybe I just moved to LA. I'm lying to you. I get a phone call. Hey, show up at this time. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Show up here. I'm at Culver City event space. We're shooting for Jennifer right now. And there was a lot of iPhones in my face. People were recording me on iPhones. And I did a scene. Auditioning. Yep. Tell me about that day.
So, yeah, so you are part of the audition sequence that we shot. The film Poor Jennifer is about a group of people. It's about three friends who decide to make their own horror movie, and so there's a sequence in it where they're auditioning actors to be a part of their film. And for that sequence, I wanted to reach out to people that I knew that were in the industry and that were talented and would give me unique things in an audition setting that would make it a funny scene. I wanted it to be the one scene in it that was comedy. It was supposed to be comedy. And you were, you were one of the people at the top of my list to call to be a part of that.
Was that because I hosted Theater of the Deranged 2 in 2013?
Although it is a great credit to have, it was really because I knew you and knew your talent and knew what you would bring when you came into the room, and that's really why I wanted you there.
So the first time you ever went to the Comedy Store, the first time ever, Rebecca O'Brien was hosting me. I had to bring people to a mic. I say, hey, you, Heather Sergio. I tried to get like three other people that bailed. But you are my road dogs. You showed up to watch me do stand-up. That was your Absolutely. First time ever at the Comedy Store. I remember you thinking, oh, the service isn't good here. Man, I was trying to get... I would have drank four more drinks. The service isn't good here. Am I lying?
I don't believe it was my first time at the Comedy Store. Because I had been a couple times for the open mic when the open mics were really bad and there weren't many people in there. But it was the first time I'd gone to a promoter show where one of my friends was going up, and I was getting to watch that. I don't remember being dissatisfied with the service, but I'm positive you're right that I was. I can't necessarily attest to 4 years after me being a GM that the service is necessarily all that much better. So.
I know when I showed up to see Tom Rhodes, right before I shot my stand-up special, that was a clutch, pivotal moment of my life because, look, Tom Rhodes told me a story. Can I tell you this?
Please.
Okay, so we're in the back of the Comedy Store. He does a set. He murders. He's the funniest person in the world. I walk back. Tony Hinchcliffe is there. I talk to him. I talk about my roast battle with Keith Carey. I'm talking with Tony Hinchcliffe. I'm talking to Earl Skakel. I was over Earl Skakel's house for a UFC one time. You know, I got some connections that you don't know about, but let's just say I'm talking to Tom Rhodes. He tells me a story that scared the living shit out of me. He goes, oh, so you're filming a special. Oh, you're going to do it in multiple venues. I did that one time all through Europe. I took a camera guy, I'm paying for his meals, I'm paying for his lunches, his wine. I'm wine and dining this camera guy. He tells me he's going to edit this all when it's done. I got a jib operator, I got some guy with a crane camera that costs $7,500 a fucking hour. I got this guy, I got that guy, all right? I started calling this guy, oh... When's the edit going to be done so I can sell it to HBO for $1 million? When's the edit going to be done so I can talk to this guy? When's the edit going to be done, you know? The guy was dodging my calls after I took him through Europe for 5 months. recording my whole tour where I'm killing these European venues, you know? The best money I spent on the whole operation, I got $750 together. I was going bankrupt. I paid a lawyer to sue and subpoena the tapes that the lawyer had. I show up with a lawyer, two policemen. He gives me some VHSs. Like one eighth of what we shot. An eighth or maybe a twelfth of what we shot. I got on a VHS tape. A 12. I filed for bankruptcy. I almost shot myself in the head. Then I got a spot on At Midnight with, that guy. So then he gets TV spots. He got to Chelsea Lately. He builds his career back up. He had none of the footage from that tour. And I was like, great. That sounds fucking great, right? So then I start shooting my special. My camera guy says, I'll edit everything for you. I'll edit everything. No problem, you know? We go around. I take him out. I'm whining and dining this guy. Every meal, every hotel room. No problem, right? I call him. I'm like, is this shit edited? He's like, get back to me in 2 months. I'm like, fair enough. Look, we shot multiple venues, right? One day he calls me out of the blue. I got great news. I'm like, yeah? He's like, I got laid last night. I'm like, I'm not sure I care about that, you know? He's like, but I went to school in Florida. You know, this girl came by. I live in a van. She fucked me in a van, you know? You know? So I meet this guy I'm sorry.
No, keep going.
All right. So I'm living in New Orleans. I'm doing stand-up. I meet this guy, right? He's living in his van, but he does stand-up. I don't know. I go to L.A. after I get my master in screenwriting, and I feel like I'm going to start selling screenplays. Not happening. I meet this guy again. He goes, I bought this camera. It's like $5,000. I live in a van. But then he shows me he's got a supercomputer in his van. He's got solar panels on the ceiling. Like, he's not a normal guy. He's got, like, editing, he's animating. He shows me his cartoons that he animated, you know? So I say, hey, come along with me. Bring your $5,000 camera. Film my stand-up special. I'll give you 50% of the proceeds of my stand-up special. You have the best camera in the world, you know? So we go all across the country. We shoot 50 venues. From L.A. to Dallas, Austin, Houston, New Orleans, D.C., you know, New York City, all right? You know, 6 months go by, 7 months go by, 8 months go by. I go, look, we got to bring on a second editor, all right? Let's bring on a second editor. I moved to New Jersey. I'm living at my dad's house. All right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm giving him no rent, but my dad is telling me about the real estate business. All right. So I get my real estate license to pay for this project. It's in the works. It's in the pipeline. You know. I say we're bringing a second editor. His name is Colin McDowell of Tall Sea Productions, you know? He's going to work on just, like, some of the stuff, right? You still work on half of it, right? Colin edits the whole thing like a G, all right? And now it's going to be on Amazon Prime July 1st of 2020. A rough cut was mailed to the Comedy Store. It hit the desk of Jody Barton. Jody Barton says, wow, this is great. This isn't my jurisdiction. He he, and then he flew to Vietnam. Is that wrong?
No, that's not wrong at all.
Okay, you didn't have a pet rabbit?
I know I did have a
pet rabbit. So I didn't go to a mansion owned by the Illuminati to watch you do a play.
I don't know if it was owned by a member of the Illuminati. It was owned by the director of Iron Man 3, and I still can't remember his damn name.
Interesting. So then you get a package in the mail. You know, Yakov Smirnoff is like, yo, where's my check? You know, like, you know, you're hiring new wait staff to deliver drinks.
I got to have lunch with Yakov before I went to Vietnam. It was great.
You got a package in the mail.
Okay.
And an old friend was palming for your newfound success. Did you know that he was a Hollywood douchebag with no connections? Or...
Wait, hold on. What, I don't. What, I got a package in the mail from who?
From me.
What are you doing?
With, with pills for your brain.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I got that at the beginning. I got that early on, yes. You know, your note that you sent me on it is still up on the wall in the office. I left it up there when I left.
And then you went to Vietnam. I was like, I'm hanging my whole hat on this guy, Jody. I remember him. We used to live together. I used to beat him at ping pong all the time. Every time we played ping pong, I beat him. What?
No, I won most of them, but go ahead.
Did we buy a ping pong table together? I'm lying.
We did.
I'm lying.
No, we did. You're not lying. We played a lot of ping pong. I loved playing ping pong with you.
And then I beat you every time, or like 80% of the time, right?
No, that's where you're wrong.
Okay.
That's where you're wrong.
I have some of the facts.
Some of them, yeah. We had a ping pong table.
What happened? Why did you crack and go to Vietnam? You're the general manager of the Comedy Store. You're at the top of the pyramid. You know members of the Illuminati. You go to Vietnam. What happened? I don't know. I'm missing this part. I'm asking you.
I didn't crack. I quit. I quit my job, and I went to Vietnam. I worked there for 4 years. The Comedy Store, it was an experience that I can't ever have imagined that I would have the opportunity to do, and created memories and relationships that you know, will be with me for a long time. So I you know, adore that place. But it's a busiest nightclub and the busiest comedy club in the country. And so it was a lot of work and it was busy and it took everything that, you know, it took all of me to do it, and which is what was necessary for the job. But I like to act and I like to write. That's what I came out here to do. And I'd just written and directed a film, and I had some opportunities possibly to direct again. And so things were opening up a little bit, and I couldn't take advantage of any of them because of the job. And so I had to make a decision. You know, did I come to LA to be a bar manager, even if it happens to be at the best comedy club in the world, or you know, do I take advantage of the opportunities that I have here and try to see if I can advance the things that I came out here to do. And so going to Vietnam was just a trip that I always wanted to take. It got all fucked up because of COVID, but leaving the Comedy Store was something that I knew I was going to have to do. So.
And you went to Vietnam for a Rumspringa. Now, for people that don't know what that word means, when you're Amish, and you're stuck in the system of being Amish and speaking that Pennsylvania German, you have a little walkabout. You have a time where you leave the cults and then you go into Western society. Many of them come back into being Amish.
The Devil's Playground.
Yes. Good movie. So you went to Vietnam, you decided, look, I like Vietnam culture, I'm annoyed that America invaded Vietnam in the 70s. What happened?
In the 60s.
It ended in 75. I know something.
All right. Yes, did end in 75. So, yeah, no, I mean, Vietnam was the other side of the world was something I wanted to do, and Southeast Asia was a place. When I was traveling through Central America, and I'd meet travelers, and I would talk to them about their favorite place in the world. Southeast Asia was what pretty much everybody said. And I had a friend of mine who was in Vietnam a couple years ago, and she called me and said, you should come here. You'd love this place. And she said, a lot of people ride motorbikes here, and you should come and ride a motorbike through the country. And it stuck in my head, and I started researching it and decided that's what I want to do. And so so I flew to Hanoi with the idea that I was going to buy a motorcycle and ride it to Ho Chi Minh. I got the motorcycle, and I got halfway there, a little south of Da Nang, and then got held up because when everything in the world shut down and the country shut down. So unfortunately, I didn't get any farther south. I got stuck in Da Nang for about 6 weeks and then caught a flight home.
And you were driving through rice fields in a motorcycle.
Yeah.
The coronavirus happened.
Yep.
You thought you were probably naked at the time that you were driving the motorcycle, and you were thinking to yourself, I'm going to be an actor the rest of my life. This is the most freeing experience. I need a cleansing from, you know, just being a bar manager and watching other people's careers grow. I need my career to grow. You're naked, you're in Vietnam, you're driving a motorcycle, you know, coronavirus happens. Now you have to wear a face mask. Now all the movie theaters at AMC are closed. What are you thinking?
I was thinking, I hope the things open up so I can get back on my bike and keep going south. That's what I was thinking for most of it.
Right.
Because I knew that coming back here, I didn't have anything to come back from. So, you know, the idea was I was going to do that for 2 to 3 months and then come back here and dive headfirst into a bunch of auditions, as well as writing and seeing what I could get behind the camera. But I knew that when I came back, there wasn't going to be anything for me. And so that was the biggest issue. And it was at first it kept me hesitant to really come back. I didn't, you know what to come back for at that time. So, but in the end, I think it was the right thing for me to get back here at that point, because there wasn't anything left for me to do. I couldn't get through Vietnam. I couldn't get into Cambodia or Thailand or Malaysia or any places that I wanted to go. So, so I came back, and now hopefully things might start opening up a little bit. Hopefully it doesn't cause a bunch of people to get sick and die. So we'll see.
I've been perusing. I've been researching everything about Jody Barton. Dr. Jody Barton Esquire. I looked at your IMDb. There's a credit I don't know anything about. It's called Hunting Alice. It's a pilot. You did a pilot. You go to Vietnam. You're getting chances to direct things. COVID happens. Whatever. What is Hunting Alice?
Hunting Alice is a project that's been on the books for a little while now. It's still in pre-production. Nothing's been shot yet. So I was asked, brought on to be a part of that series, which is what it's supposed to be. But right now, that's in a pre-production stage, and I'm just waiting to hear what the next step is going to be.
Everyone's in a holding pattern.
Yeah.
Now, as a lawyer, one time I had a contract from, I won't name the company, but they wanted to look at some Damien Shadow stuff. You know, you were gracious enough to be my roommate. Maybe I gave you a seltzer water. You gave me some legal services. You seen the George Floyd murder in Minneapolis. What is your thinking of the future of America, the future of your dream to be an actor?
Not sure how you just put those two situations together, the murder of George Floyd and my future as an actor. I don't know that those two are related in any way.
You're a learned lawyer, okay?
Okay.
But you have a dream. You're watching the news. What are you thinking? What's going on?
As you're asking what I think about what went on with George Floyd, it's the same thing that we've been seeing for years, that black people for decades have been telling us that that cops are abusing them, and then now that we have cameras, we see it on the cameras all the time. So everybody's pissed off, and they should be. So I don't know how that affects my acting career, but...
Have you seen the pallets of bricks that were laid out at certain protest sites?
Yeah, I have been seeing. I just saw a video from Canada where a guy is filming cops take rocks out of like flower beds and put them in a pile on the sidewalk by the street, and he's filming them as they're doing this. So I don't know what that's about, but that to me seems like one of those things that we should figure out the answer to first and deal with. Like, who is putting these things out? Are these state officials that are doing this? Are these private people doing this? Like, who is it? And let's stop that from happening, because people are intentionally trying to exacerbate the violence that's going on. So who is doing that? I have seen those, and I don't get what's going on there.
Yeah, you don't think that they're trying to incite riots and violence to clamp down harder on the voices of the working man?
Yeah. No, probably. Yeah. So these are big pallets of rocks. So somebody needs to be filming this going on, and then we need to be questioning the people who are doing it. If the local police force is putting out bricks for people to use to smash windows, then that needs to be answered to. Like, what the fuck? What is going on? I mean, I agree. That is one of the things that we should be able to get an answer to, and then fix that fucking problem, you know?
Looking forward, what is the future to Dr. Jody Barton Esquire? More rabbits? You're going to start raising rabbits and breeding them?
No, I think rabbits are probably not in my future. Not without a nice yard for them to shit in.
Oh, I just knew you during your crazy days, huh?
Yeah, I guess my rabbit days. Not to say I wouldn't have a rabbit again, but that experiment didn't work out well. So for me, right now I've just been writing, so I'm writing a bunch. I've got a place with Hunter Johnson, the producer for Jennifer, as well as Richard Trejo, who are all filmmakers. So I'm going to be setting up now that I'm back in Vietnam. I'm here, and I'm going to set up a space so I can go heavy into auditioning. And then writing and creating. Hunter's got a film that he is going to shoot here, and so I'm going to, from behind the scenes, going to help out on that as much as I can. The idea is to spend the next year just doing nothing but pursuing the career in acting and filmmaking, trying to make all that happen. I'm in a position where I can do that. And then I'll run out of money and be broke and have to go get a real job somewhere.
Do you know that I love you?
Oh.
I love you, Jody. You're a sweet man. We have similar goals. You helped me at certain points in my life when I needed talking to, or I needed one or this thing. You helped me. We're all in this together. Where can people find Hate Crime? Where can they find Theater of the Deranged 2? Where can they find To Jennifer, or For Jennifer?
Well, first of all, please know that I love you too, and love the relationship we have. I wish that I could have done more to help further your stand-up comedy career as the general manager of the Comedy Store, but as the non-talent part of it, it made it or difficult.
Conspiracies and dick jokes will be on Amazon Prime July 1st, 2020. All my thanks goes to Jody, but he gets none of the proceeds.
Well, I you know, I am a fan of you as a person and as a comic, so I definitely encourage people to see your special when it comes out, for sure.
I'm asking about Two Jennifer. There's three movies. Jennifer, yeah. The last one's called Four Jennifer. Four. It's confusing. Yeah. Where can people find
four
that?
Four movies. So, so you can find every... So, Two Jennifer, the number Two Jennifer, From Jennifer, and the My Movie, Four Jennifer... are all available on Amazon Prime. I believe they're all available on iTunes. And there are a handful of other platforms out there. I just don't know what they are. But you can Google any of those movies, and they'll relate to any other movies as well. If you go to Amazon Prime and you pull it for Jennifer, the other ones will come up as well. Theater Deranged 2, same thing. Amazon Prime. Do you know where else it is? I don't know if you know where... Not sure if I know what else.
No, I'm going hard in the paint with Amazon. Jeff Bezos, you know, he just got divorced, but he's still worth $1 trillion. So I'm hoping that trickles down. I had to return something to Amazon during his divorce. I really thought I was going to get half my money back, you know? So it's like, you know, the bitch gets half of everything.
Half returns go to her.
Huh? No.
I don't think half of the return would go to her. I think you still get your full return, even if he's in the midst of divorce.
Well, you're my lawyer. That's why I call you about these things. I wish I called you when I was returning that hard drive. His name is Dr. Jody Barton. He's on Amazon Prime, left, right, and center. He's also on IMDb. He, does freelance legal work for Two Blunts and a Seltzer Water. He's got roommates that are making big moves. Anything else you want to plug or say?
No, everybody stay safe.
All right, stay safe, wear your face mask, and binge watch everything that Dr. Jody Barton Esquire has done. It's all on Amazon Prime. Get a subscription, you know, do all that shit. I love you, buddy. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.